As I was sitting tonight, I was a phrase come up in my mind of that Ajahn Sumedho used for quite a few years in beginning a talk or beginning a meditation, you know, pointing to that the past is already finished, it's already done, future is still to come. Now is the knowing. He used that theme for a long time, just that emphasis on the importance of establishing the quality of knowing in now, in the present. And all of us who've studied Buddhism or most other spiritual traditions, you know, we've all heard that, we've all in some way, shape or form, that the importance of the present moment. And it's really essential to remind ourselves, because it's so common or ordinary for our conscious lives to be just about anywhere except the present moment. Or even if we are in the present moment, it's without a quality of clear knowing. In the present moment, sort of indulging in some hope for gratification through the senses. In the present moment, sort of feeling fear, anxiety, irritation, absolutely anchored in the present moment, but overwhelmed by things that cloud the mind. So that sense of being in the present moment isn't magical, in the sense that if only I could get in the present moment, then I'd be enlightened. It's also, how do we relate to the present moment? How clear are we? How much do we understand and are willing to free the mind in the present moment, in the now? And also use the present as a window, a mirror for our relationship to the past and the future. I mean, the past is not necessarily something problematic, in that if one reflects on the past, of course, from the vantage point of the present moment, reflecting on the past and recognizing those things that were unskillful, unwholesome, and establishing the clear intention to relinquish or to recognize the inherent suffering of that, then we've learned something from the past, and that this is a path of learning. Or the future is, you know, similarly, is not necessarily problematic, as long as we're using it with reflecting on it, using that understanding and clarity of the present moment to recognize what intentions and volitions are we forming for the future. Are we motivating ourselves to establish ourselves in the skillful? Well, similarly with the past, are we, you know, do we learn from the skillful things that we've done? Do we bring them up to encourage us? Or do we just forget about it because it's the past and I got to get into the present? So say the present is not some magical thing, but it is a window, and it's really the only window we have, because truly the past has gone, the future is still yet to come. We do have the opportunity for establishing the knowing in the present. So this reminder, this a recollection to be sort of establishing and re-establishing a quality of knowing and clarity in the present. I mean, it's interesting how the Buddha himself related to the present. If you just reflecting on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, The Buddha had already gone through the various extremes of indulgence and asceticism, and bringing his mind, his heart, to a place of clarity and stillness, and reviewing the past, and reviewing the past in a way that he saw clearly how the over the various lives and all the actions that had been engaged in through volition, that it had consequences. But that didn't allow him to transcend anything or liberate the mind. He saw, had a clear insight into the true nature of things, but that was the past. It's in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, then the second watch of the night was devoted to the reflection and investigation on the results of actions going into the future. What happens to various beings? What happens as the result of action? Where does it take us to in the future? And similarly, that recognition of how our actions by body, speech, and mind, the volitional formations that arise in the mind, where it takes us, how it affects us. But it was the last watch of the night with the Buddha reflecting in the present moment on the Four Noble Truths, on the experience of dissatisfaction, discontent, stress, suffering within the heart, whether it's coarse or refined, external or internal, sort of near or far. All of it was, this is something that is experienceable in the present moment, along with its cause, that it has a cause and that it can be experienced. And this is a present moment recognition, a present moment penetration. And that there is, within that same present moment, there's the opportunity for the experience of cessation, a cessation of suffering, an ending of suffering, an ending of any kind of discontent, dissatisfaction, dissonance within the heart, within the mind. And that within the present moment there's also a path to be relied upon. There is a particular way to establish attention, establish volition, that allows the mind to disentangle itself, that commentarial word that Satan Jeff really likes to use for as the translation for Nibbana, as unbinding, and that unbinding, the disentangling, the disengaging, when they're, as long as we're bound up with the reactions and attempts at manipulation of suffering and its causes, then we remain bound and entangled. And as soon as we see it clearly, apply the path appropriately, there's an unbinding. And that's just the image that Ajahn Chah uses. He said it's like some kinds of knots, when you pull on them in a particular way, they just get tighter and tighter. But there's also, say, a kind of knot where you, when you pull on it, it unbinds. It just unravels. You pull on it the right way, and it just untangles itself. It unwraps. So that this conundrum of dukkha, of suffering, is one that we need to be investigating in the present moment, and recognizing that both the experiencing and entangling ourselves within it come about in the present moment, and the possibility of that unbinding, disentangling, is just as accessible in the present moment. So that reflecting and investigating of the present, and its possibilities, and also reflect, I say, on the Buddha's encouragements of reflecting on death. When the Buddha talks about what's an appropriate recollection of death. And in order to encourage ourselves to practice, and in order to bring up a sense of urgency in the practice, and a sense of zeal to establish ourselves in our spiritual training. And there's this well-known discourse where the Buddha listens to the various explanations and perspectives on different monks, bringing up a sense of urgency by recollecting on death. And next week I might die. Tomorrow I might die. And of course he keeps going back and back, further and further, till the monk who, well, there's two monks actually, one who said that the recollecting on death in terms of if I take a mouthful of food and the time it takes for me to take a mouthful of food and swallow it, keeping the recollection of death as constant as that, or the recollection of the as I take an in-breath, I'm recollecting that death may come even before I'm able to take an out-breath, or as I breathe out, death may come even before I take an in-breath. So that the Buddha praised those last two as the one who was not living heedlessly. And if you consider it, it's sort of, what the Buddha is doing is saying that it's the present moment. Anything more than that is just projection. Hope, fear, desire. If we step out of that present moment, then it's not a sure thing. But as that sense of recollection of death is bringing us back to the present moment, that is where we can bring about a sense of spiritual urgency. Because it's in the present moment that is what has the possibility of imbuing us with the say that or that the when we imbue the present moment with attention and awareness, that is what allows us to really realize, recognize, penetrate the Dhamma. And as long as it's removed from that, then we're always sort of playing catch up, or you know, dropping off, getting lost in the dust, or dragging along behind, or running ahead of things, and missing the opportunity. You know, what comes to mind is also is the opening discourse of the Samyutta Nikaya, where the Buddha is asked, how did he cross the flood? And the Buddha replies in a rather enigmatic way of, you know, neither by stretching out or slacking off somehow. It was sort of the image is one of not going too fast or going too slow, not trying too hard or not putting forth enough effort, so that there's this opportunity for just sort of this sense of just right. And this is where attuning our attention to the present moment and attuning it to the way that we approach our practice. You know, as we bring attention into the present, you know, it isn't as if there's some sort of magical quality of the present moment, and then it's going to, lights are going to go off and you're going to somehow be illuminated. It's also bringing that quality of balance and just rightness into the present moment. So that's where it's really helpful to, what are the things that the Buddha points to that allow for a quality of penetration, or you know, the sense of how do we actually say succeed in staying in the present moment? How do we succeed in seeing clearly, or sustain clear seeing? And succeed is not just sort of everything else is a failure, I'm thinking of the qualities of Dhamma, the ittibhāda, which are the basis of, it's most often translated as the basis of success. It's also basis of spiritual power or spiritual powers, iti in Pali. And those qualities that we need, the four particular qualities that the Buddha points to, chanda, vilaya, citta, vimamsa, which are translated, I kind of like Tanjeff's translation of Ajahn Tanisaro's translation of chanda being desire, that's pretty common, just a desire. Virya, which is usually translated as effort, he translates as persistence. And I think is useful. In the same way that the word say citta, which is mind, application of mind, he translates as intentness. And then the last one of vimamsa, which is usually translated as investigation, he translates as ingenuity. And these are, you know, translations are always an approximation of a particular mental state, but the sense of desire, persistence, intentness, ingenuity, in terms of how do we practice in order to allow our attention and awareness, our knowing, be efficacious, so that it brings about a result of peace and clarity. So that sense of desire is very important, because if we don't actually bring up a sense of desire, wanting, conceiving of something that is worthy. I mean, this is where you have to start measuring desire through the lens of Dhamma. Because it isn't just sort of willy-nilly desire running around the sensual realm. It's a real longing for truth, a longing for peace, a longing for freedom. And if we don't have that in the heart, then, you know, what is it that motivates us? What is it that gets us going? So it isn't as if, sort of, you know, blanket statement, every single desire is always wrong, it's always suffering. It's when desire is seeking an object that is unskillful or inappropriate, or the motivation itself is selfish or deluded. But desire, when it is the internal intention is pure and the object is worthy, then it carries us. It lifts us up, motivates us. It moves us to do something. And there needs to be some inclining. If we're not inclining to truth, inclining to freedom, inclining to liberation, then we tend to be sort of get leaning, blowing in the wind, blowing and blowing down, following preferences, moods, views, opinions, and we're stuck there. But really recognizing that there is there's a skillful longing for what is true, is real. But that it doesn't, just because we long for it, doesn't mean it actually pops into existence through there needs to be some effort, energy, persistence, to actually put forth effort and persist in sustaining it. Not in a, and again, this is where you're always measuring things through what is skillful and what's unskillful, what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, what works and what doesn't work. I mean, this is the bottom line in the Buddha's teaching, which is something that always inspires me, is that the Buddha's basic theme is what works and what doesn't work. I mean, suffering doesn't work. I mean, it sucks. it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So the Buddha's always measuring. It's not saying, and if our effort Or so if there's some sort of dogged persistence in something stupid, then that doesn't work. We have to learn from that. We have to see that clearly. So all of these factors, we're having to use reflection and investigation to be seeing, is it working, is it not working? Our persistence, our effort, our application of energy, is it bringing about a wholesome result? Is it something that is allowing us to relinquish the unskillful, the unwholesome? So but then in order to really hold the skillful, the qualities of mind that are bright and clear, there needs to be a skillful sustaining of effort. So that persistence, effort. And similar, and that, I mean, that sort of melts into the quality of jitta, in the sense of that intentness, to really establish an intentness of mind, a solidity of attention, a firm establishing of the mind. Because if the mind isn't established firmly, then it goes all pear-shaped and wonky. I mean, it's the nature of the mind. It's formless. So it takes its shape with the what we pay attention to, what we get caught up in, you know, whether externally or internally. So that it needs an intentness to guide it in order to see clearly enough and sustain that clear seeing. Because there's this tendency of all of us to sort of skim on the surface of things, to skip, you know, like our attention sort of skims over things, and then it's difficult to sustain attention long enough to really penetrate something, or to really see it in its true light. That's the nature of advertising, isn't it? Where there's an impression that hits you, and it stimulates some desire or interest, and then you don't sort of question it very much. It's sort of like, you know, oh yeah, well, I really want that, you know. But it takes advantage of that tendency of the mind to not really sort of be to sustain intentness. And then the last quality that Ajahn Tanissaro translates as ingenuity, I think is really useful, because sometimes that investigation or wisdom, vimamsa is like a wisdom faculty. But so often it can turn into something static. It's like a piece of knowledge that if I just got that piece of knowledge, then it all sort of work. If I just remembered to say impermanence, it all sort of melt away and I'd be liberated. But wisdom in the Buddha's teaching is not a piece of knowledge or a particular insight then you can go on and replicate in every situation. You have to use ingenuity to really see, well, yeah, this is the way I said this, yeah, this really is impermanent. But then it's, how do I skillfully apply it? How do I use it so that you're recognizing the the way the mind deceives us, or the way the world it sort of entraps us. So that there's using this ingenuity to investigate and review and attend to things really skillfully. And so it's like Ajahn Chah was saying, he said, you know, in the Buddhist path, you know, we really have to, you know, develop this wisdom, you know, real wisdom, because, you know, the defilements, they've got their wisdom too. They can come up with all the logical reasons to follow a particular desire or to justify a particular irritation and aversion. You've got all of them. The logic comes rolling in. They've got their wisdom as well. So that one has to use that ingenuity to undermine and not be trapped by our, you know, basic delusions and desires, our attachments. So that the wisdom faculty becomes something very dynamic and interested in what's happening in the present moment. What's the experience? So then, you know, that's where it sort of feeds back into that, say, desire or interest or chanda. I mean, I tend to translate it as interest, because I think that it's that kind of interest, desire to sort of really attend to things that gets us motivated to really reflect and put forth effort and try to establish the heart of clarity, so that it starts to, you know, these are supporting factors for each other. But, you know, this is a process that's taking place in the present moment, and to attend to it in a way that really allows the mind to settle, to clear, to reflect. Again, not in, you know, we use the teachings in a way that you're applying the principles of the teachings. That one, you know, suffering is to be understood. And how do we? It isn't just to sort of look at everything. You sort of, you know, this is suffering, that suffering, everything suffering, and try to convince ourselves of that. But it's sort of, how do we understand that? How do we recognize it for what it is, and then be able to understand the whole process, so that you see that, well, nothing arises on its own; it has to have a cause. How do we recognize clearly and be able to relinquish the cause? How do we experience and realize? So these are these Four Noble Truths that the Buddha taught are not static qualities, but they all have their particular duty, or we have a relationship to each one that we need to respond to it in the appropriate way, so that the suffering is to be understood, cause of suffering is to be relinquished. The cessation of suffering is to be realized. Path leading to cessation of suffering is to be developed. And so that you want to be developing the path leading to cessation of suffering rather than developing the suffering. And it's just using the appropriate response. oftentimes what we do, we try to let go of the suffering, and we don't let go of the causes, and causes keep piling up. So recognize, investigating and reflecting around that, and realizing and seeing that this is happening in the present moment. We can penetrate this. We can work with this. We can, you know, develop the skills that allow us to experience freedom. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.